your clothes fall to the floor. And lit a fire while I waited for more. And now I'm running and I won't stop. I don't wanna go, I think about it every day and night. I can't let go. And hey, I'm never the same. It's 100 miles an hour on a dirt road running away. So come a little closer. There's something I can tell you. It was that you're on a coaster.
Hello everyone, you're listening to CKUT Radio and this is STEMinism, a show where we talk about science from the perspective of underrepresented groups. And today we are very pleased to have a special guest, Fred. He did his PhD in the lab of Dr. Sylvia Villeneuve at the Douglas here in Montreal, and I had the pleasure of being one of his lab mates for 9 months before he graduated and now works for CIHR. Hello Fred.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We're so excited to have you. Also, we have Noor and Zayden Paul
everyone.
In the studio.
Hello.
Yes.
So Fred, do you want to give our listeners a quick overview of Fred?
Yes, certainly. So I'm a PhD student. I defended my thesis. I'm still so used to it. I was a PhD student. I defended my thesis this past January. Was working mostly in brain imaging in Alzheimer's disease. And the topic of my thesis was related to inter-individual differences in the brain when looking at patients with Alzheimer's disease or individuals with that are aging normally. And since then, I moved on and I'm now working for the Canadian Institute of Health Research as a full-time data analyst. So yeah, that's me in a nutshell.
Wow, that's pretty cool. So let's talk a bit about the stuff you did in your PhD. You said you studied inter-brain differences. Yes, could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, for sure. So the whole point of my thesis was when we take a group of individuals, let's say we take a group of students, mm-hmm. What we usually say is that all the students in that group, we consider them to be relatively the same. Like their brains should be relatively similar. They're about the same age, about the same education, mm-hmm. etc. But what the literature is starting to show is that even when we take this group of homogenized people, there's still a lot of differences. Mm-hmm. And how we can show this is through a method that we call fingerprinting. Because what we do is we take your brain, and then we're usually able to match it to your own brain in a bank of subjects when we take like a random group of people. So mm-hmm. let's say I scan your brain now, I scan your brain tomorrow, mm-hmm. your brain is going to look more similar to your own brain compared to anyone else.
That makes sense. I hope my brain wouldn't change too much.
Yeah, right?
Yes.
But it kind of goes against the idea that everyone in a group is very homogenous mm-hmm. because everyone's a little bit different. There's those differences. So we were wondering, how important are those differences, and do they actually matter when it comes to clinical questions? Let's say Alzheimer's disease, mm-hmm. We usually assume that everyone is going to have the same trajectory, they're going to all have memory impairment, but that's not usually the case. And we were wondering, well, can we develop some methods to help investigate that? So, like, can we develop a method to help us differentiate individuals and have, let's say, a unique brain signature of your own Alzheimer's disease?
So, like, your brain's own, like, just by... So, is it all by the structure of the brain? Okay.
Well, that's the interesting thing is that... In my studies, I work mostly with functional MRI, so really the activity of the brain.
So it's more the combination of the structure and the function of the brain, which shows you the differences between neurotypical and people with Alzheimer's.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing is that we can find, let's say, this fingerprint, this unique activity of your brain or this unique structure of your brain. We can find it no matter the modality that you use. So I did it with structural imaging, I did it with functional imaging, I even did it with PET imaging.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah.
These are all very different because like PET uses like a radioactive molecule.
That's right.
Structural looks at the structure, fMRI at the activity. And are you able to extract like the same fingerprint from all of those, or is there like a different fingerprint for each modality that you use?
So that's probably where the reviewers on my paper would have liked me to go next, but that's I didn't go that far, unfortunately, because really what we were doing is taking, let's say, the volume in all the brain regions and correlating them together. So just like we correlate them between two different modalities or two different activities, and then we see if they correlate well with one another.
Got it. Okay. Thank you for explaining. That was pretty cool.
So how do you... like your research is very well positioned to be at like sort of the forefront of what we call like translational science. In your experience, like with your PhD research and having published like a lot of this work, how far or how near is that from actual reality, like of informing decision making, things like that?
Pretty far, unfortunately.
Yeah.
'Cause right now, I think a lot of, let's say, the personalized medicine work is really oriented to trying to find, or at least to trying to account for different groups, like the fact that I'm a man and then I'm this age. So, like, kind of using the characteristics, still group level characteristics, right? Mm-hmm. Like sex, age. But I think the step beyond that is more really going at the individual level. And the thing that's really tricky with that is how can you make sure that when you use a measure that's your own, that's your own reference, how can you make sure that when it changes, it's for the bad or for the good? Mm. And that's something that's really hard to do, because when you have a group, you see the group decline, you see the group change, you're able to assume certain things about the group overall. But when it is at the individual level, it's a bit more complicated.
Right, that's true. Because all of the metrics in our health are technically measured with reference to the normal of a certain group, right? Like, maybe like, oh, your blood sugar should be within this normal range based on your age, based on your level of activity, but it's all still within group averages. So I think definitely if we were to individualize all these things, it would be way more complicated.
Yeah, but I think, like, for me, at least the main message that I tried to get out of my thesis was really at least to start considering them. Like, when we do analyses, like, let's not assume that the 20 students we recruit in, like, by an ad are all the same.
Yeah.
Like, sure, we have some criteria on how we recruit them, on their age, their sex, etc. But like, sometimes I wonder if it's enough. And because we can't really capture everything in an ad in, like, 5 criterias. So maybe sometimes we want to dig deeper, ask more questions, or at least have some measures that consider variability, like the fact that some people are different.
Absolutely. I would say like the brain is unique in that sense, right? Because unlike other organs where you could say, oh yeah, kidneys in general tend to be very similar across people, but brains are quite different in like their structure and the way they activate and the different...
But that's the thing that's interesting too, right? No matter our circumstances, the way the brain develops or the way the brain is once you're fully grown, like the same brain regions are there across individual. Mm-hmm. But their shape, their function, the way they couple with other regions, that can all change from person to person. Mm-hmm. And like that adds that level of complexity. And I mean, like I'm pushing it a bit by saying this, but like it's for me, it may be one of the reasons why the brain is so complex for us to understand, because there's so much variability that we can only account for so much when we when we do our analyses, that having those measures at the individual level might help us even better.
Right. That makes a lot of sense.
Because you mentioned sex differences very shortly, what were the like specific aspects that you found to be different in the fingerprints of like male versus female participants?
That's super interesting because I haven't really looked at that much. there is one experiment that I did where I took the brain of men by themselves and the brain of women by themselves and then tried to see if there were differences in the fingerprint. And turns out that not really. Like, since it's so unique to each individual, then like I couldn't really see group differences. And that's one of the things that when I use this measure in the different projects that I did, is really it's so unique to each individual that sometimes it's not very useful when we do group level analyses, right? Because it's so distinct from one another that it's good to identify you, but like I don't think we'll have like on our phone a brain scanner to unlock like the phone soon, which is like what we would usually use a fingerprint for. But I think for now there's more work needed to even try to understand what that fingerprint does.
Mm-hmm.
So if we look at a brain fingerprint, we can't tell what group it belongs to because it's highly unique and individualized.
Correct. There are some exceptions because I did try to do it, let's say, with patients with Alzheimer's disease. Mm-hmm. And then in that case, the atrophy really spreads in the brain. And there are some group similarities. Like we know for sure that there's some brain regions that are affected across people. So the thing that I found interesting, but we didn't really dig on during my thesis, is that that brain fingerprint tends to go down like when patients start to have the disease, which kind of indicates that, yeah, there's like a pattern there that people start to converge and have more symptoms, be more advanced. We didn't really dig into it. So I feel like a little bit of this radio show is like the annex of my thesis in, because I get to discuss those things. But I would be curious to see if when disease happen, if it's more... if it changes and how it would change.
That is super interesting. Like the Alzheimer's makes the, like even though all these brain fingerprints are different, when this disease shows up in the brain, they all start to degrade in a similar way.
Yeah.
I had a question, just like forgot it.
I could ask one in the interim. So when you mentioned looking at, you know, Alzheimer's disease, we know that like diseases like that or neurodegenerative disease are typically like called diseases of aging.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was wondering if that fingerprint or that signature, you know, you mentioned that it definitely changes during the disease, but do you think it is something that's like dynamic that, or is it something that you sort of get and once you're done, your brain's done developing, that it's set and that's it, and then it only goes up or down from there?
That's a very good question. And actually, the first study that I did in my thesis, we looked at this lifespan sample. So we had like individuals that were 18 years of age, all the way to individuals that were 80-something. Mm-hmm. And then we tried to see it in the different decades of life. Is there a change in terms of like being able to be fingerprinted? Mm-hmm. So are people who are... let's say in their midlife, do they have a cleaner fingerprint? Are we able to identify them better? And what we found that was interesting is that there's kind of like this U shape. So when you're a younger adult, you fingerprint better. Mm-hmm. And when you're old, you also fingerprint better. But when you're in the middle, you fingerprint not as good. Mm. We're not sure why that is. Maybe when you're younger, like your brain is still like fully in good shape, good form, so like it's more unique, and then when you're older, then your life experiences affect your brain in a unique way that's really different from person to person. But again, that's not something we could test, or it was difficult to test in this context, but that would be where I'd like to say, because the literature also shows that when your brain develops, so when you're an infant, you actually have a fingerprint as early, I think, as 2 months old. Wow. But it starts to develop like during your teenage years and then really stabilizes right as you become a young adult. Mm. So it kind of makes sense that it would change as brain development kind of goes on. But it's, I think this is such a new field that like I'm excited to see what comes next.
Yeah.
Has anyone ever tried to fingerprint brain scans from neurodivergent children?
Neurodivergent, yes. There was this one study where they looked at individuals with that were on the autism spectrum or individuals with ADHD and in developing children and adolescents. And I think what I found interesting in that is that people that are not neurotypical tend to be less fingerprintable. So again, like it's like one study on the topic, but like I found that interesting because for them, they were advertising it more as a biomarker, you know, like mm-hmm. you can use it to maybe find something that's going on in the brain. But for me, it might be an indicator of, well, maybe there's something that's shared across those individuals that we could leverage in some other way. So, yeah.
Well, that's interesting. So I guess my question is, how would you define something that is a good fingerprint versus something that is a bad fingerprint? Like we know that people in between the bell curve that you mentioned, so like people in the mid-age have like less fingerprint reliability. And now we know that neurodivergent children might also have less fingerprint reliability. But what does that mean?
It just means less correlation. And okay. That's why I'm saying that it's kind of hard to interpret because the way we do this is really we take your brain scan at one time, whatever, like a baseline. And then we take another scan a couple of days later, a year later. And then what we do is really just correlate the two of them together. So when I say that there's like a dip, normally how we do this is we take the correlation coefficient between you and yourself, mm-hmm. and we compare that to the correlation between you and everyone else in the cohort.
Right.
So it's that distance between the two that gives us an indicator. Because if you're much further apart from the rest of your group, then it means you're more unique or more different. If you're closer, then it means there's more chances that your brain scan will be misidentified. That like the analysis is going to say that your brain belongs to someone else, actually.
Mm-hmm. That's actually what I wanted to touch on a little bit, because like when we hear fingerprints, you know, I think Mission Impossible, CIA, like it looks very fancy and cool. But what does a brain fingerprint like actually look like to you, like when you're dealing with it on a day-to-day
basis? Legit, that was the first thing I thought when I heard about your project, like way back last year. I was like, oh, he's doing like criminology stuff.
Yeah.
Sorry for interrupting.
No, and I mean, I agree. And I think for me, it was a bit of a struggle when I started this project because it was so abstract, right? Like you read the papers about it and it's like, you can identify someone, but what does it mean? And then it took me a while to kind of resolve this. And in the end, like more so me, who's more like of a coder, a programmer, data analyst, like for me, fingerprint is a number. Mm. Like, are you closer to one or are you closer to zero? So it's not this neat and fancy thing where like you have two scans that, let's say, would align with the same colors. Yeah, and then like in the action movie, you would see like pop-ups like somewhere.
That's exactly what I imagined. But instead of a fingerprint, it's like a brain scan. Yeah. That's exactly where my mind went to.
I think in essence, it's the same. I mean, it's the same principle, right? Like, I actually do have a question that I don't know. My name is Paul, by the way. I'm Fred's husband, and I've been listening to his thesis pitch probably over 500 times. I should be considered an expert as well. But I never thought about this because you mentioned a lot that you kept comparing the, you know, the correlation between yourself and then, you know, between others in the cohort.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of, let's say, you know, if you look at technology like facial recognition, it is sort of based on the same thing, but you have like an initial sort of template,
mm-hmm.
and then you match whatever that comes afterwards with yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the decision to accept that this is your face or not, I'm sure it's based on a threshold somewhere.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm wondering if that is something that, you know, would be the next step, or is that something that you are considering, you know, instead of having to depend on, you know, imagine like a large cohort of people that every time you want to do fingerprinting, you have to go into these cohorts all the time.
Yeah. And I mean, that's probably, if I kept being in academia and doing research, that's probably where I would have gone, like trying to better understand what it is, what it means, how to measure it. Because one of the things in the literature is that there's a lot of methods factor that can also influence it. And I mean, like outside of all the cool like matching of things, there's also like the number of people in your cohort, how much the people move in the scan, that also affects how it's fingerprintable, which makes sense because the image quality is less good. So there's all those other factors that also have an impact in the end on how it's measured, on how it is, and trying to understand, trying to get a perfect image of like what would affect it, how can we improve it, that's probably the next step. It's a boring step because it's very methods oriented, very math, trying to figure out like,
hey, my method, I'm a methods project guy.
It's very interesting. Yeah. It's very interesting.
Yeah, well, I mean, like for me, I was more, that was the funny thing because I came in as more of a clinic guy. Like I worked in a memory clinic during my master's, and then I come here, first project, oh, let's do a lot of math and matrix like multiplication and trying to correlate stuff that's very abstract. So yeah.
Sure. I'm curious. Oh, sorry. I'm Allie. I just joined. So I might have missed this since I just got on, but when you're like getting the fingerprints of your patients, is it just during like baseline, or are they doing some kind of task while you're doing that?
That's a really good question.
Yes, very good question. And actually you can do with both.
Okay.
And what's super interesting is that depending on the task that they do in the scanner, it can be more or less fingerprintable.
Okay.
Like in my own study, I only had two tasks, which was a sensory motor task and a resting task.
Okay.
And even correlating the two together, there's like really this fingerprint. And initially, you would think that, let's say they do the sensory motor task, should activate the same brain regions, so it should be not as much fingerprintable.
Yeah.
But that wasn't the case. It was like you can still be fingerprinted. It's like, which kind of reinforced this idea that your brain has this signature that shows up no matter what you do in the scanner.
That's so cool. I always thought that people's brains would, like when it comes to basic things like sensory motor tasks that involve the same motor cortex and the same sensory cortex and so on, I always thought that would be super similar. It's very cool that this is fingerprintable and it shows up differently in different individuals' brains. Like that,
yeah.
That's,
and I mean,
a lot to think about.
Not only that, but one of the analyses we did is we really looked at the brain networks, right? Because there are some that are come back across everyone. But the one thing that really stood out to me and that we ended up putting in a corner supplementary figure somewhere, but that's, for me, that's one of the highlights, is that when we take a random assortment of brain region, not networks, not anything, if we have enough of them, we can fingerprint. Doesn't matter where in the brain we look, doesn't matter if it's a specific network. There are some networks that are better than others, but even when we take this random assortment of brain region, this signature is still there. We can still identify you.
Are these on patients with a condition
Well, that's a big caveat in the field right now, is that a lot of those studies are conducted on younger individuals. Mm-hmm. In my case, it was cognitively healthy participants that were aged between 18 and 88. You should remember that from my defense, Paul.
Yeah.
But, did you even listen, yeah. Paul?
Just too many numbers. Too many numbers all the time. Yeah.
But I'd say that most of the studies in the field right now use a single cohort, which is the Human Connectome Project, which is really a nice cohort. There's a lot of people. There's a lot of really good sampling imaging. There's a lot of modalities, but it's mostly individuals that are white. It's mostly individuals that come from the same regions in the U.S., highly educated. So it kind of faces the same idea that we face everywhere else in replication in science, is that like our cohorts or samples are not super diverse. And that's definitely something that I would have liked to explore more. But since we didn't collect data for this, we're kind of limited. We can't push recruitment for specific data. But yeah, so unfortunately, very homogeneous.
Mm-hmm. So you've been mentioning a lot of things that you would have done had you continued research. But you chose to move on to a more industry-oriented position.
That's right.
So I guess I have two main questions that I think everyone is thinking about.
How?
Why did you move into the industry? And do you think that by your position, you would still be able to pursue these goals that you have, even if it's not in the same way?
Very good question. And I'd say that it's been quite an odyssey. Like changing from academia to industry, right? We're like, through our whole process in academia, we're kind of, what we want to do is really become PIs. We want to become professors. We want to do research. That's what we live and thrive on.
Yes, that's exactly it.
And I'd say that for me, it was really the same. And like, research is really what I love to do. I love to teach. I love to research. I love to ask like really random questions at 2 a.m. and then like have to code something to check it. But the thing for me with academia is that there's so much pressure to go further to get anywhere. Like, if you want to be a PI, then it takes so many papers, really high impact journals. You need to be from a good university. You need to keep going even when you become a PI. You need to publish more.
Yeah, and they have like a limit of how many, like, you need to have a minimum number of published papers in some institutions.
Correct.
And even to become a PI, you need to have to do a postdoc, sometimes two or three postdocs, depending on your experiences. And it depends also on how many papers you're able to push out. And depending on the field you're in, it can be significantly difficult to put papers out. Like, if, let's say, you're working on some model that requires just years to be able to sample. Like in your case, if you do, for example, longitudinal studies.
Exactly. And I think for me, that's something that I was willing to put up with it. But then I saw a lot of colleagues of mine who went to do, let's say, postdocs, and then they were there for a long time, couldn't get a job afterwards. And then it would also mean that I would have to travel, right? I would have to do a postdoc abroad, because doing a postdoc in the same city that you did your PhD, that's not looked at on well.
Right, that's true.
So I think for me, it's just the accumulation of those things, the pressures, the behaviors of some people in academia as well. Those are things that, like, I wasn't necessarily keen on keeping going. So I kind of sought out alternatives. But even then, I'd say that it's kind of hard to look outside, because as PhD students, we're so trained on working within academia that we don't really know that all the skills that we have can be applied elsewhere. And I was listening to your last show, and then I think you had a discussion about that, like, of how we're like, we have many skills as PhD students, and then that's something that the PhD doesn't really train us to apply elsewhere, to apply outside. But I mean, I was coding in R, I was coding in Python. That is still what I do in my day to day, and like, I still work with data. I still work with in the research environment. So those are all things that I gained through my my PhD, and then applying now. And I'd say, yeah, the reason was balance, work-life balance. I wanted to be able to travel.
That's a big thing.
Yeah,
but I think it's also your, I mean, you know, from having seen you grown through the years, it's also your ability to sort of approach problems and solve them and know where to go, know where to look. And sort of, you know, like, how to test hypotheses. I think these are things that, you know, you learn through your PhD, your discipline, you know, your determination and all these things too. So outside of just the, you know, your theoretical knowledge and hard skills, but you've also learned, you know, a bunch of other things too.
Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds to me like academia poses a lot of barriers. Like, not necessarily barriers that even have to do with how good you are or how motivated you are. Like, some people are unable to leave the city that they did their PhDs in. Some people have a lot of different barriers that get in the way. And it seems like academia is really made to favor some people with certain privileges that allow them to go on and push further.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, like, it's no secret to anyone, but let's just think of the money we get when we're in academia, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's like, it's not a lot of money.
You got money?
Getting paid?
Just mentioning in passing.
It's like that meme where it's like, you know, you keep getting less and less, and then the last one, it's like, are you getting paid for this?
Yeah, exactly.
Incidentally, it's from the Millers movie,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Incidentally, they just announced increases for PhDs and postdocs.
Yes. Oh my God.
You have to ask. I mean, because he works at the CIHR now, so he holds all that.
So that's what I was going to ask about. I was like, hey, were you involved in this? And B, thank you.
Well, to be fair, I've only been there for 3 months, so not really. And like everyone in Canada, we see the budget when it comes out. So like when the news came out, then I learned the information at the same time. But I think in general, this announcement is something that I would have been really happy with as well during my studies, right? Mm-hmm. I think when I was still a PhD student, the salary at McGill had been capped at the same the same max for like, yeah, I don't know, 10, 15 years, yeah, something like that.
Too
yeah.
long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So now I have to admit that one of the things that I was so happy with starting a new job is then when you open your bank account after gaining your first paycheck and you see the amount there and you're like, is that right? Is that like the right amount?
Wow. Yeah.
How do you feel now about your decision to leave academia? Because I have noticed that people in academia often kind of look down on anyone who leaves as like, oh, you're not doing your postdoc. Like anything you do outside of academia is like less worthy, I guess. And
yeah.
So how do you deal with that shame?
That's a very hard question, because I feel like for me, I had the feeling that throughout a lot of my PhD, it was always constantly that I wasn't pushing hard enough. And then once I really made my decision to leave, then it was like I heard messages from a bunch of different people saying that, well, why do you leave now? You're doing good. Like you're going to have a hard time in the industry. They still work like crazy every time. Like it's not going to be better once you leave. And then at that point for me, I had really willed like my decision, like that's it. I want to leave. And then I left. But even leaving is a bit isolating sometimes because we don't have those resources here at the university. Like, we don't do a class on how to use our PhD skills outside of academia. And I think sometimes it's a bit of a struggle. I still remember when I applied for jobs and I had publications in there and I'm like, yeah, I mean, like academic, like when you do anything academia, you put your publications. Mm-hmm. This is like your prestige. And then I remember talking to the first person I talked to in human resources, and they basically disregarded that whole section. They didn't understand what that means. It's valueless outside of academia.
This is crazy to me. That I did not expect.
Yeah.
Yeah. You spend like 5 to 8 years, however long your PhD takes, just trying to get papers out.
Yeah. I know.
And then someone looks at it as
like in high impact journals too. Like,
yeah.
I know. Yeah. But in the end, like once you get out, it doesn't really matter, because what they look for is more the skills that you did during your paper, right? Like for me, if I break it down, my first paper was really about like the fingerprinting, right? But how do we translate that to industry? Well, for me, I banked on the fact that I could code. I could code Python, I could code R. I did machine learning in that project. That's what I sold forward. Not the paper itself, because no one cares, but like, yeah, I know it's weird to say, like, but that's really how it is outside. And like in the beginning, it was hard for me to believe. But the more people I talked to, and I mean, even my husband, like he was also in academia, did his PhD at Queen's in epidemiology, now out in industry as well.
Oh wow!
And so I'm the worst shame. Like, so we had so it's like, well, at least I didn't go full industry, but yeah, that's.
You know,
it took the like, same decision.
That's pretty cool, though. I feel like what like Amelie described is that like people like academic people regard as people who leave academia with shame. But yeah. What I've also found is that industry people are just smiling with paychecks. Yeah.
And because
like,
we sleep.
Like, they sleep.
Oh, I don't know about that, but yeah.
Like I find that there's a very funny balance where I can just imagine there's like a two-side wall, and on one side you have academics that are like resentful that people are leaving, and they're like postdocs and they're getting paid like 30K a year or something. And then like on the other side you have like people on the industry that are like quite pleased with what they've done, and they're happy that they left all that behind.
And honestly, I mean, I'd say I think it really depends on I guess on where you land to, right? Because now that I've seen the other side, I know some people who are thinking of going back to academia who don't like it as much in industry.
Uh-huh.
Because it's always a balance of things, right? In academia, you work more in the evenings and everything, but we're also being sold on the flexibility. The fact that like if like a week or a weekend you need to go or you want to work abroad, that's something that's doable. But it's not always possible on when you take a job in industry. And I think for me, I definitely do not regret it. I think for me, the moment that really made me say, okay, I definitely do not regret it is last month I went on vacation.
Wow.
And that was my first paid vacation.
Please don't
throw the V word lightly like that.
I know, I'm sorry. But for me, it wasn't even just the fact of going to vacation, but it was the fact that I left my work phone at home. I left my laptop at home. I did not have any way of looking at my things when I was abroad. And then during my travel, I couldn't even think about it. You know, I didn't think about working, and then going back to it. When I came back, I was like, okay, well, yeah, like I'm ready for work, you know. But when I was taking vacation in academia, well, once I was working during, but then once I left, then for my vacation, I'm like, I need to work. Once I come back, I'm like, ugh, I worked the whole vacation. Now I'm gonna work again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you like in industry still keep tabs on the literature on like what's being published or what's recent and whatnot, or is that now an element that you don't have to worry about so much?
It really depends. Yeah. I mean, first of all, like I no longer work with anything neuroscience related, right?
Right.
So, I'm kind of lucky because at my own in my own team, there's a lot of PhDs and postdocs, so we have our own journal clubs. And funny enough, I've done more journal clubs now at my work than I used to do during my PhD. So
my condolences. I hate well, those.
I know. But they're actually nice because I think the main difference that I see doing them now is that you do them with a purpose. Like you do them to try to show something that could improve the business. You show them just to maybe take a break and discuss and like... have fun with an article or think like how we could improve our processes. So it feels like there's more purpose rather than sometimes talking about papers that half of your lab doesn't understand. And then like, yes, there can be discussion, but then like you add it to the pile of things you want to do and the pile is like 50.
Right.
Like,
yeah, that's true.
How does your day to day differ like now than before?
I start at 8:30, I finish at 4:30, and I have an hour like of break during the day. Oh my God. And I'd say that for me, that's the biggest change. Because like in terms of task by itself, like what I work for is for the funding analytics unit. And what we deal with is people who have questions for the CIHR in terms of how much money we gave to an institution or internally, how much money or pulling out different applications. And a lot of what I do nowadays involves machine learning, involves cleaning data, sending data. So I'm really into R a lot, Python here and there. So weirdly enough, the type of day-to-day isn't that different in the sense that I have a terminal open in front of me. I have R open. I have Python open. Mm-hmm. I code, which is most of what I was doing to my PhD. But now I start really at fixed times. I have team meetings. It's a lot more collaborative as well because I have meetings every week with my supervisor. I have like team meetings every week as well. We share a different tricks to help each other out when we work on data. So yeah,
I think it's not the during the day activities that change, but it's the after work activities, because from seeing you for the past 3 months, it's just been different. Like you were able to shut, you know, work out.
Yeah.
After I mean, you used to talk.
4:30. Yeah. Before work.
Exactly.
And I think in the longer run, at least this is from my experience as well, is that your work doesn't become you.
Yeah.
Like you, if things don't work out, it doesn't work out, mm-hmm. and it's just fine. Like, it's okay. We'll move on. We do other things. It's not like there are other things that we can do. Because, but, you know, in academia, I feel like a lot of the times, like, your next 3 months depend on this one, you know, click when you send the code to run in R. And it was like, oh, okay. So now it's going to be a shitty 3 months. It's we're not going to have anything good. But, you know, it doesn't really happen that much.
That's anymore. True. And I think, like, that shift is, for me, what's been the hardest coming out. Because I'm still dealing with some level of, I guess I could call it academic PTSD. Like, you're still thinking of, like, I'm still finishing work sometimes, and I'm like, should I really not check my stuff?